Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. Founded in 1964, USCO, or the Company of Us, was one of the first art and technology collectives in the United States to create unique and ephemeral performances featuring slide projectors, audio tapes, moving images, oscilloscopes, refracted lenses, and lasers. On March 3, 2019, two of the group's co-founders, Michael Callahan and Gerd Stern, joined together for a film screening, rare performance, and conversation moderated by Paige Rosansky, curatorial associate from the Department of Modern Art. Drawing upon the influences of technology and religion, USCO utilized everyday materials, new communication apparatuses, and Eastern and Western mysticism to create artworks that bombarded and overloaded the senses. Two films by USCO and Judd Yalkut from 1966 were shown as part of the program, Us Down by the Riverside and Us, also known as Building the Tabernacle.
Engineer and artist Michael Callahan was born in 1944 in San Francisco, California. From 1961 to 1964, he was the technical director of the San Francisco Tape Music Center, an early electronic studio whose purpose was to explore tape as a creative medium. There he collaborated on works with artists including Morton Sabotnick, Pauline Oliveros, Steve Reich, Ramon Sender, David Tudor, Anna Halperin in the Dancer's Workshop, and performed in John Cage's Atlas Eclipticalis. In 1964, he recorded On the Seventh Day Petals Fell in Petaluma for Harry Partch, and that same year, he became a founding member of USCO. From 1965 to 1969, he was president of Maverick Systems, Inc., a manufacturer of specialized electronic equipment for media presentations, including the design and installation of the media system for the World Discotheque. From 1968 to 1971, he was the technical director for Intermedia Systems Corporation, a multimedia production company that manufactured slide projector programming and control equipment for numerous government agencies, schools, museums, and corporate clients. In 1972, he founded Callahan Associates, a consulting service to museums and institutions regarding the deployment of audio-video exhibits. And since 1989, he has been the president of Museum Technology Source, Inc., a manufacturer and distributor of audio-visual equipment, primarily to museums. He also held the position of supervisor of film studies, studios, and electrical engineer at the Carpenter Center for the Visual Arts at Harvard University from 1977 to 2004. Poet and artist Gerd Stern was born on the French-German border in 1928 and emigrated to the U.S. as a refugee from Hitler in 1936. Stern studied at the City College of New York and briefly at Black Mountain College. During the 1950s, he befriended beat poets, including Carl Solomon and Allen Ginsberg, and was an active participant in the San Francisco art scene. He lived on a barge in Sausalito, managed Harry Partch and Maya Angelou, and hosted jam sessions with Chet Baker and other jazz musicians. He worked at public radio station KPFA and was a publicity agent and journalist, writing for Playboy and other magazines. A founding member of USCO, Stern's first show of electronic sculptures and collages was held at Allen Stone Gallery in 1962. In 1963, his one-person exhibit at the San Francisco Museum of Art featured the multimedia performance, Who Are You and What's Happening?, which was also performed at the University of British Columbia with a lecture by Marshall McLuhan. Stern was president of the public company Intermedia Systems Corporation and currently serves as president of Intermedia Foundation. He has published several books of poetry, including First Poems and Others, 1952, After Image, 1965, Fragments in 2002, and When Then in 2018. During the past few years, Stern has been an artist in residence at DAD in Berlin, Germany, the Bemis Center for Contemporary Art in Omaha, Nebraska, and the Emily Harvey Foundation in Venice. In 2013, the Stanford Library acquired Stern's papers. Stern is 90 years old and lives in northern New Jersey. He continues to give poetry readings and exhibit collages. I'm going to welcome them both to the stage now for a conversation. So I thought we could start off speaking about how the two of you met in San Francisco in the early 1960s.
Well, it certainly was fortuitous. And I had been wanting to do something, encouraged by George Culler, who at the time was the director of the San Francisco Modern Museum of Art, which was at a very different location than it is now in the Civic Center then. And he not only sent for all of the pieces from the Allen Stone Gallery, which had been my first show to show at the museum, but he extended several nights of a large auditorium. And he said, after all, you're a poet, you can read poetry. And I said to him, I'll bet there'll be a half a dozen people, or maybe 20, but in a big auditorium, I'll have to think of something else. So I had this concept of multimedia, which was really a result of my having been exposed to the ideas of Marshall McLuhan in a report to the National Educational Broadcasters, which turned into Understanding Media. And I needed some help. And a fellow poet of mine, Michael McClure, introduced me to the San Francisco Tape Music Center, and Morton Subotnick and Ramon Sender and Pauline Oliveros said, Michael Callahan, who at the time was in his teens, is our technical director, and he's more or less what you're looking for to help you. And my God, here we are, over half a century later, still working together. But that was the first time, and it was a very ambitious effort called, at the time, Who Are You and What's Happening?
Michael, do you want to describe a little bit about that performance event?
Sure. It was overly ambitious. We involved a panel of sociologists on stage and four groups of four people in niches around this auditorium at the San Francisco Museum.
Including the mayor of San Francisco.
Yeah, including the mayor and Allen Ginsberg and a number of museum socialists, you know, the San Francisco Society. And these four groups, we'd wired up telephones and microphones, and the panel of sociologists could monitor the conversation and then call up on the phone to attempt to direct. This was, I think that we as a society were still acclimating to things like the telephone and new ways of getting information. And also we had closed circuit television, which I think was early. I remember back in those days, you couldn't buy a telephone, they all belonged to the phone company. But we did manage to get Pacific Telephone to loan us some phones by saying, you know, it was some demonstrating telephones to grade school students, you know, rather than this bunch of freaks. Anyway, long story short, it just broke, this marble hall, it just broke into feedback and screeching and squawking. There were also slides going. Many of them were like the verbal American landscape, the first slide thing here, the words, which had been shot by Gerd's old friend, Ivan Majadrikov, and also by Stuart Brand, the Whole Earth Catalog. Stewart was just out of the Army, where he had been a photographer. And Alfred Frankenstein, the dean of West Coast, indeed national music critics, had wanted to go to a Bartok concert, but his editor told him to go cover this, so he was not pleased. And the next morning on the front page of the San Francisco Chronicle was a review saying, landmark of a flop. Some horrendous eggs have been laid in the public halls of my time, but none so horrendous as to have scored a kind of success. In other words, it was that bad.
And it made me feel like Stravinsky from Rites of Spring, because, you know, that was a big scandal in Paris. This was only a little scandal in San Francisco, but it certainly was an odd thing to look at the newspaper and see that we had created landmarks of a flop. And it was not until years later that I happened to be on the same plane flying from San Francisco to New York that I was sitting next to Alfred Frankenstein, and I said hello to him, and he said, I didn't think you'd ever speak to me after that review I wrote about you. I laughed like hell. I said, you made me feel like Stravinsky. Whatever.
After the Verbal American Landscape, which was the first part of the performance we saw, how did you go from working on that piece to really becoming USCO? USCO started with three founding members, the two of you and Steve Durkee.
Well, I mean, I had been involved in various communal activities before that. A group of poets called Seven Stray Cats, and Jack Gilbert, et cetera, and my ex-wife. And we had read our poems and made brochures all over California. And that was a communal situation. And the two things that have contributed really was community and collaboration. And I was involved with the founder of KPFA and Pacifica Foundation, Lou Hill, and I was a producer at KPFA and did various things, including poetry by well-known poets. But Grace Clemens, who was a Jungian, was on the station, and she spoke about Ananda Kumaraswamy, who was an art historian, Boston University, et cetera. And he wrote about the artists in traditional societies not signing their work, but being like everybody else, carpenters or plumbers, and not being special people. And I loved that idea. So I suggested to the painter who we were very close to and who with his wife had bought an old church building in Garneville, New York, the idea of a group, and I explained to him that Michael and I had worked together in San Francisco, and he was necessary for the whole technology. Of course, at that time, vacuum tubes, and now he's very digitally oriented, and he's managed to do this all basically self-taught through six or seven different kinds of technology through the years. And Steve said, well, why don't we get Michael to come to New York? And it worked out, strangely enough, although he was San Francisco born and raised. And he came to the church, and we were working together, and it seemed to me and to the three of us that this kind of cooperation deserved an identity. And we talked about various possibilities, and I liked the idea of the company of us, called USCO, and that's what we formed. And eventually it wound up being 50, 20, 30 people working together.
Do you want to speak a bit more about the early media theorists like Marshall McLuhan, who you met and did performances with, and the ideas that you were thinking about media back then? It's so different. We saw this performance with this original equipment, with slides, with different sound. Now we're in a digital world. So what attracted you to these theories back then?
When I was about 10, 11 years old, 1955, we had just got a TV set. And one afternoon, President Eisenhower was giving a speech. And for some reason, either advertent or inadvertent, I turned the sound down on the TV and turned on the radio and was watching, having the visual of the President Eisenhower, but the audio was, I don't remember, a soap opera. But for whatever reason, I found that very intriguing and started, I wouldn't say be pretentious enough, even me to say started thinking about media, but I realized that the media were different, audio, video. And so then when the opportunity came along at the to help to be on very early at the San Francisco Tape Music Center, I jumped at that. I was in high school. It's really, you know, hard to say what motivates and what one finds appealing. I think, though, that that's what makes us all interesting because of the differences of what we find appealing.
And, you know, the ideas of Marshall McLuhan, I think of it in terms of prophecy. In other words, Marshall was 50 to 60 years ahead of himself, and he was prophesizing what was going to happen. And he was right. That's what happened. In biblical times, prophecy wanted things to be now, right away. And through history, prophecy has differed very much in terms of how time. I think right now we're no more than 10 or 15 or 20 years ahead of what we know. We don't know what's going to happen 50 to 60 years from now. But Marshall was at a different time when it was possible for him to foresee that far into the prophetic future. And it appealed to us at the time to know him and to know his ideas and to further his ideas through our own work, starting with the Verbal American Landscape. And it's amazing that we were able to see that today in a three-screen version on this very lovely gallery that we are in our nation's capital. I'm a refugee, you know, having some this federal government's involved with the work that we've done in the last more than half a century is part of my patriotic heritage here from 1936 to 2019. It's very touching, at least.
I'd just like to say very quickly, thank you, Paige, for your work, and also to the people here. When we arrived, everything was set up, had been tested, so we really appreciate the work of everyone who made this possible. This is a far cry from the early days when we would load things into a VW bus and drive 400 or 500 miles and then schlep it in ourselves. I mean, here we arrive by taxi and everything's set to go. I mean, this is a good reason to continue to live longer, because you never know what what your reward is going to be.
So maybe we can talk a bit about the performances. So these are some drawings by Judy Stern, and they kind of outline a map of all these different, you would go to universities and the Filmmaker Cinematheque and put on these performances, and each one was different and unique, and they featured all types of things like strobe lights, moving images, as well as the slide carousels. Can you talk about the equipment? Michael, you built equipment.
Yeah, Michael has tremendous memory compared to me, for instance, of everything that we did and the elements of performance and of presentation that came about. So he can certainly talk about that.
Yeah, well, just very quickly, back when we were doing this in the early, in the 60s, it was rare to see more than one image at a time, unlike today. And those images were fairly slow-paced because video editing was very cumbersome. And so, it would hold, a shot would be held for a number of seconds, as opposed to today, where you turn on the TV and it looks like a strobe light, a police car flashing with all the images, coming in at 4 or 5 a second.
Well, we were kind of pioneers of that kind of thing. Very funny.
So it might, looking at day, one might say, so what? But back then, that's why we were using the 4 projectors, which was as much as we could afford. The carousel projectors had just come out. So we used the 4 there, 4 images, and 4 tracks of sound. And then we also had later added some 8mm and 16mm projection. But this was all seeing what it would do, what the effect would be. McLuhan had mentioned disregarding the content and concentrating upon the effect. So
at the time, reviews of your shows said that they were overwhelming, noisy, bombarded the senses.
Reviews were all over the place. Some people got it. I remember at the Cinematheque, I think it was in New York in 1965, we had an intercom, front to back. The intercom came on, somebody had just stormed out. I said, who was that who just left? I said, that was Bosley Crowther, the critic from the New York Tribune or a major critic at the time. So, some people, critics stormed out, but then others embraced it.
Do you want to talk a little bit about, for instance, this is the slide controller that you used, and you can see the inside and also the audio control panel. But you built these out of IBM surplus parts?
In Woodstock, New York, Kingston, the next, the major town, there was a surplus place that scrapped IBM computers, P&D surplus. And we would go down there and see what was available, and then
Michael would always brag about how many thousands of dollars IBM had to spend to put this thing together, and we would buy it for $10 or even less.
So this is the controller, the pictures, and that we weren't using all its capability, for flashing lights and changing things automatically. We had 4 projectors, but by adding a control, we would be able to multiply the impact, the effect. So, and the thing still works. IBM made quality parts from IBM.
So, and Michael went through all these phases of the kinds of technology that changed. He's more or less self-taught, but he is capable of today's technology as well as the technology that we started out with, which were vacuum tubes. Unbelievable.
Yeah, it's a technology of available, you know, what could be scrounged. The Tape Music Center was like that also. We didn't have any money. And just trying to get a few good tape recorders in the same room at the same time was a real effort. And so we had to make maximum use of whatever technology.
It's amazing. I mean, I'm a refugee. The whole tape technology was developed by the Germans during the Nazi period and was brought to the United States by Army officers of the U.S. Army who founded Ampex, the first really wonderful tape recorder brand. Yeah.
Do you want to talk a little bit about the sound and images that we heard?
Well, let me just go on the Billy Master, on Verbal American Landscape. The slides, many were some of which were originally at the San Francisco Museum at the Who Are You? And then various people shot them, Ivan Stewart. People would shoot slides of words, and the sound there was Billy Master with Billie Holiday. That was a somewhat abbreviated version, and normally would be longer. And we did Billy Master as one of the four tracks of the mix to establish an attempt to establish a historical context. But then the Billy Master we feel stands by itself.
You may have recognized some of the voices. Among them were Allen Ginsberg, Marshall McLuhan, various poets like Theodore Ruthke and Wallace Stevens, M.C. Richards. Who else, Michael?
Tim Leary.
Right.
Marshall McLuhan speaking in Verbal American Landscape on Billy Master, I think, was talking about what would be a valid human strategy if the world is being merged together at a very rapid clip, I believe he said, due to the media. You know, should we fight it? Should we resist it? You know, is it going to deprive us of all our individual selfhood? Which I really felt last night at the self-service checkout counter at CVS. I mean, I was...
the other thing, McLuhan understood that where he was in terms of technology, and he said to us at the time when we first met, he said, I'm a Victorian. I don't like the toasters which are pop-up toasters. I like the kind where you have to open them up and turn the toast around. That's how I am. So I understand why these people are doing things which follow some of the ideas that I have written down, but I don't subscribe to the contemporary technology yet myself because I'm a Victorian. It's an interesting idea.
On the second performance, The Mix, Adrian, my wife, very gallantly stayed up several nights sorting through boxes of, you know, selecting from the thousands of slides. We hadn't really done, I think the last USCO road performance was in 1967. We did recreate things in 2005 for Anthology Film Archives performance, but we really haven't seen this for 50 years. But it, that was true to the style and the spirit of groups of slides, somehow related thematically. And on the sound, I went through quite a few audio tapes, reel to reel, from the period, and copied some of those onto CDs, and we're playing the CDs simultaneously. So it's really quite asynchronous. There's no, I think the only thing we agreed on, or, you know, that was programmed, so to speak, was that on the raga, we would fade out on the raga and the sunset slides. But aside from that, I mean, it wouldn't be repeatable. We couldn't do that again. It would be different.
That's the thing. I mean, each performance was unique, and you took some of these ideas about randomization and simultaneous the bombardment of images and noise, right? You took these kind of things that McLuhan was writing about and put it into practice in some way. And it was new at that time, so I think it's really interesting that maybe we can talk about kind of the changes in technology from when you're doing these works till now. It's so different how we experience.
Well, I mean, we were into multiplicity, no doubt about that. And we overdid it. And it took us quite a while to realize that we were overdoing it and that we were kind of getting people stressed. What happened is that we did a wonderful venue performance at Kresge Auditorium at MIT, and the next day we got a telephone call from a gentleman who said, "I don't think you probably know who I am. My name is Harold Edgerton," which we both gasped about because we knew exactly who he was. You know, he said, "I saw that performance," said, "you know, I'm a motorcyclist," and we had shown this 3-projector thing of motorcycles going. He said, "You don't have to do things that loud." He said, "And that strobe light that you had is puny. I'm inviting you over to my offices at MIT so I can show you what a strobe light is all about." And we were quite aware of the fact that he invented the strobe light and that he had done all of Cousteau's technology for under the water. So that was a great opportunity for us, and we knew him for the rest of his life.
Yeah, and we did take his advice, and I think began to end the show with nature and crickets or whatever. I think back in the old days, we'll probably run an hour and a half rather than a half hour today. So consider yourselves lucky.
Maybe we can just talk about one more thing. We saw it in the films that we first watched, but you had, not only did you do these performances, but you also created environments. And so you did one at the Riverside Museum, which then moved to the Tabernacle, which was at your church. Do you want to talk a little bit about those?
But before we do that, let's just one more time. The progress from overload to meditation was definitely an USCO direction, and it was intentional. And it was Edgerton who had called it to our attention, but we should have understood it all the way along. But, you know, multiplicity and overload is engaging. You get habituated by it, and you like it. And to have somebody tell you that it's not really working that well, it was wonderful that somebody was conscious enough. As far as I'm concerned, and it's kind of a Jewish interpretation, is consciousness has to do with intention and motivation. And those two things elaborate into consciousness, and we had those in those days. We thought very carefully about why we were going to do it and what we were going to do, being practical. But we were turned against ourselves by overloading.
Do you want to talk a little bit about the environments?
Sure. In addition to the performances, we also, whether with paintings, some kinetic sculpture, Gerd's collages, so there were physical objects aside from the ephemeral performances, which were shown at various museums, and more recently, starting in 2005, at the Tate Liverpool Summer of Love, and then Whitney in Freiburg currently. So there is a physical manifestation of Usko's work. Much of it has not survived, but at the Riverside Museum, we were given the opportunity in 1966 to basically take over the museum, which we did, with five rooms with various themes. You can see the red painting, the Shiva painting, and the tie-dye. People would lie on a rotating table, which rotated slowly, and the lights above the tie-dyes would pulse. A lot of publicity on that. Barbara Waters, NBC. I mean, that all of a sudden became a cover of Life, a big deal. But much of the publicity didn't hit until after the show had closed, and so then we started getting people showing up at the church in Garnerville, saying, you know. So then we constructed what we call the tabernacle inside the church, and that's what was going on in one of the films, and there was a parachute for the top of it, which we would project onto, and the six sides all had a large painting, typical of the six paintings. And the black and white picture there is the opening of the tabernacle. You can see the paintings on the wall, and there's a fountain, water spraying. That was fire earth sand.
And light.
And light, yeah. And there's a group of filmmakers who'd come up from the
Lincoln Center.
Lincoln Center Film Festival. So that was the other thing that what was what's now referred to, I believe, as immersive environments.
I guess we'll just end by, again, thinking about this idea about communication technology changing patterns of human associations, relationships, and do you have any thoughts on?
Well, the transition from analog process, which is basically an organic process, to digital information was a tremendous transformation change. And we were basically, as Usko, analog people. And I've had a lot more trouble than Michael adapting to digital literacy. He has this incredible ability to adapt to any kind of technological
only
change.
Only necessity.
He's a little younger than I am, yeah. So that's a different necessity.
So, I mean, there's so much to talk about. I feel like with USCO, we're just touching the surface, but I wanted to thank you both so much for being here today, and thank you to the audience for coming and supporting this program.
Thank you, Paige.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.